Hi, everyone. It's Jen. Cam and I are really excited about this week's sponsors. We have Elemis and Iconic Protein Drinks. So make sure you listen to the ads in the middle of the episode so you can get your great discount codes. Enjoy.
How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast. A podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hello, Jen.
Hi, Cam. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, considering we're in a major toilet paper crisis across the world.
We really are. So today I went on CNN and they had the psychology of why people are buying toilet paper.
Yeah.
And I was like, And it really does have to do with, say, being able to control something.
Comfort.
Being able to be prepared.
Yeah. Comfort.
And I told my coworker, I'm like, listen, if I'm going to go stock up on something, it's not toilet paper. If worse comes to worse, you can use a t-shirt, if you know what I'm saying, right?
Washcloth.
As long as you still have wash, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going for food. We need food, like good. If I'm going to be quarantined for 14 days, I need ice cream with chocolate syrup.
Yep.
I mean, if we're going to do it, I'm going to do it right.
Oh, I was reading an article about, I think it was a Vice article, and they were interviewing Costco shoppers and asking about toilet paper. And the one guy's like, you know what? I've been in countries that have been totally devastated by certain crisis. And the last thing they stock up on is toilet paper. And he goes, if this really is the apocalypse, do you think anybody really cares about a clean ass?
Thank
and
you.
It's true.
Thank you.
Who cares?
I know.
You know, but whatever.
I'm whatever.
Got to do what you got to do. But anyway, enough dirty talk, potty talk, as they say. What you got for us today?
Jen? Okay. Let's see. My little intro here. You know, sometimes some of the, and we've both done this, I'm going and looking and researching something else, and you see something and you click on it, and then it takes you somewhere else.
Rabbit holes.
So I discovered this case, and I had never heard of it, which, I mean, that's whatever. But then, and I could be wrong, because believe me, I am once in a while, not very often, but this person has not been flashed out there a lot, and I cannot believe it, because he is a true P.O.S.
Really?
I mean, woo.
Well, you piqued my interest.
Here we go. On July 21st, 1972, a man named Gerald John Schaefer picked up two teenage girls who were hitchhiking. Now, you know, hitchhiking back then, that was kind of a thing, so that's not strange in and of itself. Schaefer told 17-year-old Pamela Wells and 18-year-old Nancy Trotter that were hitchhiking that it was illegal, that you could not hitchhike in Martin County, which is false because that's not true at all. It was not illegal, but you know, they're young and they believed him. So he offered to drive the girls home and he took them to the halfway house where they were staying. During the drive, he suggested that the three meet up the following day and he'd take them to the beach, and the girls were excited. They're like, okay,
heck yeah,
you know, this is cool. We get a free ride, get to go to the beach. The next day, Schaefer would pick up the women, but instead of taking them to the beach, he drove them to Hutchinson Island off State Road A1A, which is a swampy, desolate area. I looked it up, and it's very, like, the trees with the great big roots and, you know, that kind of, like, very Florida-ish
kind swamp, of like, yeah, Florida swamps.
Trees,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So once they were there, the girls were forced out of the car with a gun and bound. As he was tying the girls up, he would make sexual comments to them, as well as telling them that he was planning to sell them into the sex trade. He took the girls to an area that had trees with a bunch of exposed tree branches that came up out of the ground. He made the girls stand on the roots. He placed a noose around their neck. And the idea was, is if the girls would struggle, they're going to fall off the branches and the noose would strangle them. So the branches are, you know, they're like 2 feet up off the ground, but enough that that noose was just so you had to stay there. The whole idea that they couldn't move, you know what I mean? That was his way to ensure that the girls would not move. Now, as demented as his plan was, and as it was coming to fruition, a phone call came in and Schaefer had to leave. But he swore to the girls, do not escape. I will be back.
Ooh.
The minute he left, the girls, hell no, they fought furiously to get loose. They did. They got out of their bindings and they finally succeeded and escaped. They made their way to a highway and flagged down a car. The car happened to be, can't make this up, a police officer. And the women had quite a story for the officer. You see, Jen, the man who had kidnapped the teens, he had actually planned to murder them. They weren't getting out of there. He was going to murder them. And so, you can't make this stuff up. He gave them his real name. And you know, this police officer knew this man. He knew this would-be killer because that phone call that Gerald Schaefer had received when he was tying up the girls, it wasn't just a phone call. It was a radio dispatch. Gerald John Schaefer was a police officer with the Martin County Sheriff's Office. The rescue girls were taken to the closest police station, which just happened to be where he was employed.
Oh my goodness, really? No, I mean,
crazy,
like,
right?
You
can't make this up. Gets better. You know, these killers, we've talked about this, they're not very smart. Like, they're maybe smart, but they're stupid. So when Gerald Schaefer realized his victims had escaped, he panicked. He called his boss, Sheriff Richard Crowder, and he said, I've done something foolish and you're going to be mad at me. That's what he's telling his boss, right?
You think? Yeah.
You think? Gerald Schaefer proceeded to tell his boss an unbelievable story, claiming that he wanted to teach these hitchhiking teens a lesson. So he fake kidnapped them. He fake kidnapped them, tied them to a tree, left them out there in the middle of this desolate, swampy area, right? Boss, of course, was like, yeah, I don't think so, buddy, and immediately fired Schaefer on the spot.
Well, thank God.
Schaefer was charged with 2 counts of aggravated assault and was released on a $15,000 bond.
I guess they couldn't do kidnapping since they were hitchhiking, you think?
Well, just stay tuned.
Okay. All right.
Just wait. He would only serve 1 year in jail, and he got 3 years probation after serving his jail sentence. Now, sadly, this was not the only crime Schaefer committed, and they would be much, much worse. So we all know bad things happen, and often when we look back, it seems like we should have known and put it all together. Unfortunately, it's too late when we discover this, and if we had figured it out earlier, lives would have been saved. And this is the case with Gerald Schaefer. Gerald Schaefer was born in Wisconsin in 1946, and he would remain in that state until 1960, when he and his family moved to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Gerald was the oldest child in the family, and just like a lot of the cases we do, there are some problems within the family unit.
Yep.
Gerald's father was verbally abusive and an alcoholic, and he was never faithful to his mother, Gerald's mother, his wife. He was rarely home. Gerald said that his dad's favorite was his sister and gave him little to no attention. In his teens, Gerald became obsessed with women's underwear, undergarments, whatever you want to call it. And he also became a peeping Tom, spying on a neighbor girl named Lee Hanline. Now, it was at this time that he began killing animals and also cross-dressing.
So he's got the whole thing going for him.
He's
checking off every box on the list, right?
Yep. Hey, the little test you take. Yeah, he's checking.
Yeah, they should have just had a great big light flashing down on him, like one of the spotlights flashing serial killer. Yep.
Gerald would say later that he only started to wear women's clothes to avoid the draft into Vietnam. And actually, he was successful in not getting drafted, partly because of that reason.
Well,
I know I kept thinking Jamie Farr.
Yeah.
You know, MASH.
Well, I kind of had to laugh because when you said because of the draft, I'm at first going, well, I don't think women's clothes are as warm or as more warm than men's clothes. But yeah.
Women's panties sure aren't, Jen.
They sure aren't.
During his trial from abducting those two girls, psychologists would testify that Gerald had numerous sexual hangups.
Really? Thank you, Captain Obvious.
At age 12, he had begun to experiment with bondage and sadomasochism.
At 12?
12.
Lord.
He said, and I tried to find this many different ways because it wasn't sinking in my head. I couldn't visualize it. And a lot of times when I'm writing this, I can see it. Like, it's in my head one way. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying? So he said he'd like to tie himself up to a tree, much like, this is age 12, by the
way.
Tie himself up to a tree, much like he did those girls. He would become aroused. And then he would masturbate and fantasize about hurting other people, women, of course, or young girls in particular, while he was hanging, which is autoasphyxia, right? Mm-hmm. But also, his thing was more like hurting himself, like the hurting equaled being turned on. Does that make sense?
So pain,
as far as I can
pain,
say,
sexual yes. arousal. Okay, so when he tied himself to the tree, he didn't like bind himself to the tree. He actually made a noose.
I would think it would be a noose to kind of cut like autoasphyxia.
Okay.
But I saw this many different ways, and that's why I surmised it was this, because some of the other stuff that I read didn't make sense to me, that it was like he would go by a tree and try to hurt himself, and then he'd get turned on. And I was like, wait, what? I didn't.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
I kind of put them all together, and that's what I think he was doing.
Okay.
As a child, when he would play with friends, he would volunteer to be killed. That's right. He was always the one that wanted to die in battle, or he'd die in, say, a shootout at the Alamo. He was the robber that got shot by the police officer in Cops and Robbers, which, you know, that is a little peculiar because most kids want to be the one that is successful, but okay.
Right.
At 14 years old, Gerald began seeing a young girl named Cindy. Gerald would talk Cindy into helping him act out his fantasies of what? Raping her. Ugh. Now, 3 years into this, she'd had enough. And she was like, yeah, this something's not right with you. I'm out. So they did date for 3 years. And there was some peculiar sexual activity. But then, you know, she's like, no, I'm out. In 1966, Gerald said that he went to a psychiatrist because he wanted help with all of his dark fantasies. But he claims they didn't help him at all. And he still was hearing voices telling him to kill people. Gerald thought about the priesthood as a calling, and he was actually
I mean, what a switch.
He's got what? Just wait. He's got quite the professional resume.
Yeah,
shall we say? So he thought about going into the priesthood.
I was gonna be a priest, but I decided just to be a murderer and rapist.
That is exactly right, because he was turned away from St. John's Seminary, where he recalled that they said he didn't have enough faith. Now, he was so angry that he quit the Catholic Church altogether.
Hmm.
That'll show him.
That will.
I'm just going to quit being a Catholic.
I'm going to quit being a Catholic, like, and I'm going to kill people. That'll show him. That'll show him how much faith I have. Show him how wrong they are.
Yeah, don't let the door hit you on the way out, buddy. After all of this, he got angry. So off to college he went, and he decided he's going to do what? Become a teacher.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. On October 2nd, 1966, Nancy Leichner, age 20, and Pamela Nader, age 21, went to hang out at Alexander Springs Park in Ocala National Forest with some cute boys, right?
Mm-hmm.
As they're there, they're all hanging out. The boys decide that they're going to get in the water and, you know, play sports or whatever they do in the water. And the girls are going to go take a walk. They would never be seen again. A witness would come forward and say that he noticed a man walking behind them a bit, almost as if he was following them.
Mm-hmm.
Police tried, but could never locate the man who they believe may have caused the girl's disappearance.
Hmm.
So Gerald, at college, he's working toward his dream of becoming an educator. And, you know, while he's studying, he landed a student teacher position at Plantation High School. Now, while he was there, a 22-year-old named Carmen Halleck called her sister-in-law on December 18th, 1969, to tell her that she had an appointment with a male teacher from a local junior college that evening. The teacher had told Carmen that he may be able to get her a job as he had worked for the government in an undercover capacity. How many times have we seen this, right? Come on now. Carmen was very excited by all of this, and she even went out and bought a brand new dress and black leather boots for the meeting.
Wow.
Carmen was never seen again after that fateful meeting. Carmen's sister-in-law went to Carmen's apartment on Christmas Day to check on her. In her apartment, she would find Carmen's driver's license and car keys. Missing was that new black dress and boots. Carmen's whereabouts would remain a mystery until January 1978. That's almost 10 years later.
Oh my gosh.
When her skeletal remains would be discovered in Boca Raton, Florida. At the time of her disappearance, that area in which she was discovered was under construction, becoming a subdivision. Uh-huh. So her body obviously was dumped there and remained hidden for almost 10 years.
Wow. Well, good thing the family finally got closure, though.
So, Jen, I know you're going to be shocked by this, uh-huh. but Gerald's dreams of becoming a teacher were shattered as he was dropped by the teaching program. But you know, Gerald, he was able to talk his way back in. But again, he got in trouble. And he tried to talk himself back in and convince his superiors to see it his way. And they're like, absolutely not. And they dropped him. In fact, one of the supervisors in charge of the student teaching program made a comment about, if I ever hear of you being in charge of young people, I will do everything I can to make sure you get fired.
Mm-mm-mm. Really?
On September 8th, it's important these dates because they're so in line with him living his normal life doing this and then, you know, just keep going. Like, it's just shocking to me. The cooling off period for this fella was not long. Let's put it that way. On September 8th, 1969, Leah Hanline Bonadies had went missing and her car was found abandoned in the Fort Lauderdale parking lot. Now, Lee had just married a man by the name of Charles, and it was only about a month before she disappeared. Now, they had sort of a rocky relationship, but, you know, when you first get married to somebody and you're young, I think that's learning to live together, right?
Right.
You're learning to cohabitate with somebody. So that wasn't out of the odd. Friends really believed that Charles had nothing to do with this. However, police went to talk to Charles. Now, Charles told police that Lee had told him that an old neighbor of hers had called her up out of the blue and offered her a job with the CIA, Jen.
Not the CIA.
Charles came home that day on September 8th, and he had found a note from Lee saying that she had gone to Miami to speak with her old neighbor about this job. She was really excited. Charles laughed at her, you know, earlier mm-hmm. when she told him. He's like, are you crazy? Whatever. Well, her old neighbor, Jen, was none other than Gerald Schaefer.
No way.
Lee's brother, right? Shocker,
shocker.
Right?
Dun, dun, dun.
Lee's brother reached out to Gerald, who relayed this weird story about her. Now, Gerald claimed that Lee had called him and asked for a ride to the airport because she was flying to Cincinnati, Ohio. So he simply gave her a ride. And, you know, she wasn't really sure what time she was flying out or landing, but that she'd call him later. And yeah, after that, Gerald never heard from her again.
That sounds plausible.
Totally, right? Mm-hmm. Just a few months after Lee's disappearance on December 29th, 1969, Peggy Ron, age 9, and Wendy Stevenson, age 8, vanished from Pompano Beach, Florida. These little girls actually didn't even know each other, but they had met that day at the beach and they became fast friends.
As you do they when actually, you're that age. Mm-hmm.
Right? You meet anybody. It's so cute. They actually did go to the same elementary school, but they didn't know each other. They didn't really, mm-hmm. you know, hang out. I guess you don't really hang out at 9, but you know what I mean. They're hanging out. They're having a great time. So the girls want to go get some ice cream. So they get some money and they go to the parking lot to buy some ice cream. Now, the store clerk would later tell officers that a stranger that he described as a white man around 6 feet tall, weighing somewhere around 200 pounds, in his 20s, with sandy colored hair, grayish eyes, and a humped nose,
ooh,
that made me laugh, actually bought the girls ice cream. Little girls disappeared. Their bodies still have never been found.
That Florida man.
Something wrong.
Gators.
Hello. It was about at this time that Gerald's wife, Martha, filed for divorce. And this is May 1970. And she filed for divorce claiming extreme cruelty towards her. Now, I couldn't find much else out about that, but I could imagine that he probably was not a very nice person to live with.
Think?
But, yeah.
Really?
Here's where we see yet another job change. Devastated from all of this, Gerald decides he needs to travel for a few weeks and figure out what he wants to do with his life. Now, if he can't be a priest or a teacher, you do the next closest thing, Jen.
Astronaut?
Close. At the end of 1971, at the age of 25, Gerald would graduate from the police academy and become an officer.
That's right. He was a police officer.
So on January 5th, 1972, a troubled 22-year-old named Belinda Hutchins made a mistake that would cost her her life. Hutchins, who was married to a drug addict with a 2-year-old, had been arrested in the past for solicitation. And according to her husband, she had many affairs. I guess you call them affairs. They're married, but whatever. And that she flaunted her affairs in front of him. She was last seen taking a ride with the man in a blue Datsun, her husband said. She would never be seen again. Oh, and just one of those affairs she had that I didn't mention, she was having an affair with this guy. His name was Gerald Schaefer.
What?
After graduating from the academy, Gerald applied to several different police departments and even the Broward County Sheriff's Office, but failed the psychological test, so they wouldn't hire him. Shocker.
Go figure.
Not to be deterred, he kept at it, and finally, the Wilton Manors Police Department hired him. On February 29, 1972, 13-year-old Deborah Sue Lowe started her mile-long walk from her home to her middle school in Pompano Beach, Florida. Deborah would never make it to school that morning. Her school bag was found in a trash can only about a block from her house. It's a mile. Like, that guy was stalking her, right?
Yeah, of course he was.
Now, at first, police thought she did what, Jen? What did they always think at first with the 13-year-old?
Got a runaway.
They thought she ran away. Well, her parents were adamant that Deborah would never do that. She had never done it before. She had never mentioned it. There was no reason. They weren't having problems. It's just no way. Deborah, to this day, has never been found and is still considered a missing person. Her family believes that Deborah was a victim of Gerald Schaefer. Much like some of that other stuff. You know, he's in there. You see, Gerald worked with Deborah's father, and he had even been to their house for parties and backyard barbecues, birthday parties and things like that. He'd been to their house several times.
Oh.
So I was thinking about this. Like,
he definitely,
You're taking one of your friend's baby girls, you know? I mean, that's a whole new level of sick. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all sick, but.
But do you really think that they've got levels of morals that they abide by? I mean, some do. Someone, like the last episode with Leslie Irvin, he's like, well, I like kids, so I won't hurt them.
Not this fella. Mm-mm.
Yeah, he is a POS. So Cam and I lately have been talking about trying to get a bit healthy. But I know, don't laugh, but it's really been hard for us to get enough protein in our diet.
You know, I talked to my doctor about it, and he suggested trying a protein shake. Well, most of the ones I've tried aren't exactly tasty.
And the ones that are tasty are filled with sugar, and they are really, really high in calories.
So when Iconic Protein sent us a sample to try, we were a bit jaded, but excited. We expected the same protein powder as what those bodybuilders drink.
But boy, were we wrong. Iconic Protein drinks are delicious, and they have a much better texture than anything we've ever tried before.
They use only grass-fed milk protein, which is richer in beneficial nutrients, which keeps you fuller longer, and I love that.
I usually drink one in the morning. I mean, it seems like I never have time to actually sit down and eat breakfast. And my kids, they love the chocolate truffle one because it tastes like chocolate milk.
Yum.
And since it's low in sugar, I don't even mind them having it.
I like to have mine as an afternoon snack. It tastes like an ice cream shake, but not as thick. Plus, it gets me that boost I need to get me through until dinner.
Iconic drinks come in a variety of flavors. There's chocolate truffle, vanilla bean, cafe latte, which does have a bit of caffeine, the turmeric ginger, and the cacao and greens, which gives you a full daily serving of organic vegetables.
Iconic protein drinks are low sugar, low calorie, low carb, and you can count on them to taste really good. In fact, they're rated number one for the best tasting protein shake on Amazon.
And we are so happy that Iconic Protein has partnered with us for this episode, and they are giving all of our listeners 25% off their first order. So if you'd like to try Iconic Protein drinks, go to drinkiconic.com or Amazon and use coupon code OurTrueCrime and get 25% off your order.
That's Our True Crime in lowercase letters. And you'll get 25% off when you order your Iconic protein drinks through Iconic.com or Amazon. This past year, something big happened to us. We talked about it with you.
We don't like it, but it was inevitable.
Last year, we turned 50. That means we need to wear reading glasses.
That means every day we get invitations to join AARP.
That means we act more like our mothers.
Just because we are 50 doesn't mean our skin has to look 50.
Now, I'm sure you know the one thing that helps you look young is a good moisturizing face cream. And by the way, it's never too early to start using a great face cream.
So we were thrilled when we were invited to be sponsored by Elemis, the number one selling luxury skincare brand in Britain.
Elemis products are an innovative brand of science with the chemistry of nature. Their pioneering formulas and remarkable transformative results are what truly set their skincare apart.
The product they sent us to try is called Pro Collagen Marine Cream. It's clinically proven to reduce the appearance of fine lines and wrinkles in just 14 days. The secret to Pro Collagen Marine Cream is a blend of seaweeds and algae, which is fantastic for hydrating, revitalizing, and toning the skin.
It's amazing how this super gel cream is so moisturizing, yet it feels so light on your skin. Honestly, this cream gives you serious results.
Elemis is an award-winning brand that has achieved a cult-like status. Beauty editors rave about the product. There are cruise lines that even use Elemis products in their spas. And Pro Collagen Marine Cream? One is sold somewhere in the world every 8 seconds, and it has hundreds of 5-star reviews.
Don't believe us? Try it for yourselves. Go to elemis.com/US/OurTrueCrime to sign up and claim a sample of Pro Collagen Marine Cream. It's valued at $45, but using our code, you can get it for $10, and that includes shipping. But you better hurry up. Supplies are limited, and it's first come, first serve. So go to elemis.com, that's elemis.com/US/OurTrueCrime, to get yours before it runs out.
It's March 1972. Gerald Schaefer earned a commendation for his role in a big drug bust. 1 month later, on April 20th, he's fired. The exact reason's a little unclear, but from what I could gather and what I could see in the research, and this is so creepy, he would purposely pull over women, younger women, and he'd give them violations. Sometimes, you know, legit speeding, sometimes just stupid stuff. But then he'd take their information that he got from their driver's license, take it back to the station, run it on the computer, and get their number, and then call and ask them out.
Oh, that's so creepy.
Now, could you imagine? Can you imagine? Like, hello? Hi, Cam. This is a Detective
Schaefer,
whatever,
yeah.
Right? It's creepy.
I know I pulled you over today, but I was just wondering if you wanted to go have some drinks. Yeah, that's
so
really
creepy. So he's out looking for a job, you know, having some problems. But near the end of June, he signed on with the Martin County Sheriff's Department and moved to Stuart, Florida. Now, these fine folks took a chance on him, and they hired him partially because of his recommendation letter from his former supervisor, the Wilton Manors Police Chief, Bernard Scott, who sung his praises, Jen. Boy, he could walk on water.
And he can bury women in water, too.
Oh, yeah. It's discovered that the letter that had been composed was by Gerald.
Oh.
He did it. And actually, the police chief that he worked under had been quoted as saying that Gerald used poor judgment and he did dumb things. Those dumb things included kidnapping those teen girls and trying to claim it was a misunderstanding. And he'd only been working on the job for a month. But okay. Yeah, he's great. Great guy.
Piece of work.
So, Jen, this brings us up to where I started the episode, where Gerald had kidnapped the two girls who escaped, and which we talked about right at the top. And it also brings about Gerald's undoing. Finally, after his boss found out what he did to those girls and kidnapping them and claiming it was fake, I said he was fired on the spot. He was charged with false imprisonment and 2 counts of aggravated assault. Now, Schaefer was released on a $15,000 bond. No one knew the secrets that Gerald Schaefer held, and him being released on bond would allow him to strike yet again. This time, however, he would not be as lucky as he had been in the past to get away with it.
Good.
Poor girls die, though. On September 27th, 1972, Gerald Schaefer was free on bond, pending trial. 17-year-old Susan Place and 16-year-old Georgia Jessup went missing from Fort Lauderdale. Lucille Place, Susan's mother, told authorities that the girls went to the beach that day with a man named, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Shepherd.
Wow. Now, this is somebody totally different, though, right? I mean...
No, it's him.
I know.
You're joking, right?
I am joking. Come on.
Okay. Oh, my God. So Mother Lucille told authorities that the man had driven a blue-green Datsun, and for some reason, and I'm thinking this, I added this, mother's intuition, maybe, with your young girl, mm-hmm. she actually wrote down this guy's license plate.
Thank God. That's so smart. You should do that all the time.
Now, mind you, the girls went with him September 27th of 1972.
Mm-hmm.
It took investigators until March 25th, 1973, to actually track the plate back to a man by the name of Gerald Schaefer. Now, Schaefer was serving time for assaulting those two teens, the girls that he fake kidnapped, right? Mm-hmm. He trick kidnapped, whatever. Authorities learned that Gerald was actually out on bond in September. So when he was out on bond, he went to kill and abduct and torture and murder Susan and Georgia, right? And then he went to jail. So he was actually serving jail time. So the police are excited. They're like, wow, he's trapped. Let's go talk to him. Now, of course, he claims he had nothing to do with the disappearance of Susan and Georgia, and he doesn't even know them, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Gerald's story starts to unravel on April 1st when some men who were out collecting cans, now this is about, what is that, about a week, 7 days, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Some men are out collecting cans on Hutchinson Island, same island the other two girls, right?
Right, the swampland.
Spread it out. They come across bones. After a long 4-day wait, the victim's skeletal remains are identified by using dental records. The remains are determined to belong to Susan Place and Georgia Jessup. The medical examiner's findings would indicate that Susan Place had been shot in the jaw. Crime scene evidence indicated that the two girls were, quote, tied to a tree and butchered.
Oh.
They had been abducted, tortured, and then murdered. Their bodies were then buried near where they had died on Hutchinson Island. He loved the tree thing.
It went all through his childhood, right? Since he was 12.
Exactly. Police get a search warrant, and on April 7th, they search Gerald Schaefer's mother's house. Gerald had used a spare bedroom in his mom's home to store some of his stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So they're just going to go check it out. Now, by stuff, I mean trophies and items that say guilty in more ways than one. This is awful. An address book that belonged to Belinda Hutchins and a purse that belonged to Susan Place are found. A passport, driver's license, and a book that was said to belong to Colette Goodenough and Barbara Wilcox. See, we haven't even mentioned those two yet.
We haven't.
Mm-hmm. Their skeletal remains would not be found until 1977. Since it had been so long, officials could not determine the cause of death, so no charges were filed against Gerald for those two. I got pictures of this stuff, too. It's unbelievable. Also discovered were several pieces of woman's jewelry. They find a book detailing mutilation murders of women with sketches to go along with the macabre descriptions. Now, as if that is not scary enough, they discover newspaper clippings, newspaper articles about Carmen and Lee, the women who went missing in 1969. It was later determined that some of the jewelry, as well as a gold tooth, that were found at his mother's house belonged to Carmen. Another piece of jewelry recovered belonged to Lee. Schaefer would say that Lee, this is the killer. Now, Schaefer was an old neighbor, remember? Mm-hmm. And that is true. They were neighbors. Gerald Schaefer would say that Lee would undress with her curtains open just to tease him. That's why he was angry at her, apparently. Her remains would be discovered in 1978, but no charges were brought against Gerald for her murder.
So I guess he took somebody's gold tooth out of their mouth after he killed them as a trophy? Mm-hmm. Sick bastard.
That wasn't his first time. We're going to get to that.
Okay.
More jewelry recovered from the home was determined to belong to 14-year-old Mary Briscolina, who vanished from Broward County with a 13-year-old girl named Elsie Farmer in October 1972. Their skeletal remains were found in early 1973, but again, since no cause of death could be determined, no charges were filed against Gerald Schaefer. With their bodies, Schaefer pulled their teeth out of their head and spread them out farther away from the bodies. The guess here, I mean, authorities thought the reason he did this is he thought it would be more difficult to identify the bodies.
Ugh, Lord.
Gerald would never admit that he murdered or even knew any of these victims, but his writings told a different story. He would describe the women and what he did to them, which was rape, torture, and murder them. He would then bury them and dig them up later to rape them again. Gerald would say that this was all fiction, and he did not actually do all this. On May 18th, 1973, Gerald Schaefer was indicted for the murders of Jessup and Place. In October 1973, Gerald was convicted, finally, thank you, on two counts of first-degree murder in which he would receive concurrent life terms. While he was convicted of murdering only two victims, he was suspected in all of these, as I stated, but authorities really believe there's many, many more. We're going to get to that in a second. Gerald Schaefer frequently appealed against any of these convictions, yet privately boasted, both verbally and in writing, of having murdered over 30 women and girls.
Jesus. 30?
He's a POS. Now, his wife, Teresa, who he had met after the first one left him, would only visit Gerald one time in prison. And that was to serve Gerald with divorce papers, as Teresa had found another love. Elton, ready? Mm-hmm. Elton Schwartz, the public defender who represented Gerald Schaefer. She went on to marry him.
Wow.
Thank you.
Yep. Nice. Huh.
Now, in prison, Gerald, he didn't stay quiet. In 1979, he'd find love again, Jen. Love in the pokey. This time to a Filipina lady named Ilan.
Uh-huh.
Now, Ilan came over from the Philippines, and she would live with Gerald's father. They did file documents to be married, and I guess as best as you can do that when you're in prison, they were married. I mean, they didn't really have a ceremony, but they were married by, you know, whatever. Jen, you'd think that love was going to last forever for Gerald, but it didn't, because guess what? 1985?
Uh-huh.
Elon got her green card. She was out. She's out the door. Like, day got she green card. She out.
Yep.
See you. Bye-bye. She out. Now, maybe it was because of sadness or grief, whatever. But Gerald decided that he was going to have a few people killed for hurting him so like this. Now, he's in prison, right? So he decided he's going to do this plot, and he's going to have his ex-wife, that wife that married his lawyer, killed. He's also going to have the lawyer killed. He's also going to have the judge killed. He's also going to have the prosecutor killed.
Oh, yeah.
Now, he's kind of a talker, so of course. The plot was discovered, and Gerald was moved to a maximum state prison, Stark, which actually houses Florida's death row. I bet you're thinking now that maximum security prison's going to tame old Gerald, but no, it doesn't. It doesn't, Jen. This guy's he's something else. So while he's in prison, I guess he gets a little bored or something. So he comes up with some rather unique ways to help pass the time and, hey, make a buck or two at the same time.
Oh, good.
So using some friends on the outside, he would post ads in sex magazines posing as various people who would do things for money. Now, his characters were always female with names like Dominatrix Mistress Felice or Matron Miller. You get the idea,
mm-hmm.
right? So for a price, Mistress Felice would send her soiled panties to you and that you could wash them for her.
Oh.
Right? So Gerald would also act.
Hey, if this works, I might have a new calling.
right? Yeah. He's a man. And I'm thinking, when they, like, the underwear, I don't, I got all, I'm guessing the people on the outside who were female that helped him had those, because otherwise I think you're going to notice that you get a man's underwear. You know what I'm saying?
Sent to you. Well, you'd think. Who knows?
Mistress Felice has a, she's got a secret. He had lots of stuff going on. Another one of his side hustles was that he would act as his fellow inmates' prison lawyer on the inside. He would get, and this was kind of smart, I'm going to be honest. He would get information from them under the guise of helping them, but then he would take that information and give it to authorities, right? Mm-hmm. The secret information. So one of these inmates actually told Gerald where he had hid his victims' bodies. And with that, Gerald gave that information to prosecutors. Prosecutors were then able to go after the death penalty, and it succeeded in getting it for this particular inmate. Interestingly enough, Gerald would get to know a few famous people on the inside. Gerald and Ted Bundy kind of became friends, I guess, if you can say that. And they would, you know, commiserate over various issues that they encountered while killing women, such as how to clean your car seats when the victim urinates on them in the process of dying. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. That's what they talked about.
Well, I guess that's a problem that needed to be solved.
Another person Gerald got to know on the inside was Otis Toole. Now, we all know that there was lots of rumors that Otis killed Adam Walsh. Mm-hmm. Now, Adam was the son of America's Most Wanted host, John Walsh, whom I've met, and very nice guy, by the way.
I would think talker. He would be.
He's a talker, which I loved, but because, you know, I'm nosy and I'd like to find out stuff. But anyway, always on the take, Gerald decided, came up with a plan. So he writes to John Walsh and he poses as Otis Toole. And he tells John Walsh that for $50,000, he would tell him where Adam's remains were. All you had to do is give me $50,000 and I'll tell you where your son's body is. Now, if you remember, they located Adam's head, sadly, but that was it.
Right.
John Walsh, thank goodness, ignored the letter, and Otis Toole grew tired of Gerald and his stupid shenanigans and lying and doing just being shady, and they ended up not talking. Now, if Otis Toole's not going to be your friend, you got a problem. You know what I'm saying? Now, after Bundy was executed, Gerald's old girlfriend from high school reached out to him and proposed that they write a book similar to the one that Ann Rule wrote about Ted Bundy, The Stranger Beside Me. She saw dollar signs in her eyes, right? Gerald loved writing stories, as I mentioned earlier, and he would also have them accompany his stories with graphic, macabre pictures.
Well,
right? So he would draw this.
I can see that because he's pretty creative, like that whole Jerry Shepherd thing.
Yes. Wait till you see these pictures. Check out our blog. Maybe in 2 months, but whatever. So Gerald loved writing stories and he loved the attention even more. In collaboration with his ex, whose name is now Sandra London, Killer Fiction was published. Now, Gerald insisted that these stories were art and fiction, but prosecutors say they're the actual descriptions of the crimes that he committed, and he was trying to pass them off as fiction. This is pretty grotesque, let me tell you. Gerald, in typical Gerald fashion, began writing letters to attorneys and friends. It's almost like he does all this. It is so for attention, but it's so blatantly idiotic and like, does he not realize he's the typical I'm smarter than every person in the room kind of guy?
Right.
You know what I mean? So he starts writing these letters to attorneys and friends. In a letter dated April 9th, 1991, he says, quote, "What crimes am I supposed to confess to? Farmer? Briscolina? What do you think, murder demons?" That's one of the short stories. "Is. You want confessions, but don't recognize them when I anoint you with them, and we've just gotten started," end quote. So it's the shock factor or whatever, you know, but he's saying that I'm admitting this to you, but then he'll go back and say not. So it's like throwing the limelight out there, wanting the attention, and then, oh, I didn't do that. That's fiction. It's fiction, right?
Piece of shit.
He's disgusting. Another letter is disturbing in content, but it also raises the amount of people that he killed or claimed to have killed. A letter dated January 20th, 1991 begins, "As you know, I've always harped on District Attorney Robert Stone's list of 34. In 1973, I sat down and drew up a list of my own. As I recall, my list was just over 80. I'm not claiming a huge number. I would say it runs between 80 and 110. But over 8 years and three continents, one whore drowned in her own vomit while watching me dismember her girlfriend. I'm not sure that counts as a valid kill. Did the pregnant ones count as two?
Oh.
It can get confusing.
Oh, no.
Yes.
What?
Now, those letters are going to come back to haunt him. At this point in time, the true crime genre is becoming popular, mm-hmm. and some books are being written, and they come out, and they name Gerald Schaefer as a serial killer.
Which is true.
Well, he's not happy about that. So,
and see, that's surprising, because I would think somebody like him would love to be named a serial killer.
He does, but so what are you going to do to get more attention, right? Mm-hmm. So he's not happy about that, so he does what serial killers who are called serial killers do when they're mad and file lawsuits against them for libel.
Nice.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the cases, of course, were dismissed with Judge William Steckler, who said that Gerald Schaefer was undeniably linked to numerous murders beyond the two for which he stood convicted. The judge then added he boasts of the private and public associations that he is based on the reports that he is a serial killer of world-class proportions and is only arrogant perversity which propels him towards this and similarly meritless lawsuits in which he claims otherwise. In a letter to Sandra, now that's the ex, Gerald would claim he did in fact kill Peggy Ron, age 9, and Wendy Stevenson, age 8, and then cannibalized the two girls.
No.
Gerald and Sandra would become engaged. She's one of them. Just wait. They would become engaged in 1991. But when she broke it off, Gerald was furious and started sending her death threats. Now, she broke it off, Jen, because Sandra, you see, she had met a new guy. And she really liked him. And they eventually became engaged, too. Now, his name? Danny Rowling, a.k.a. the Gainesville Ripper. Yep.
Yeah, so she's got a certain type.
So the two of them went on to collaborate on a book called The Making of a Serial Killer, The Real Story of the Gainesville Murders, a psychological memoir which included Rowling's confessions to five murders along with other capital crimes for which he had not been charged. The book was illustrated by 50 pictures hand-drawn by Danny in prison.
Yeah. Would he be able to make money off that, or is that state by state?
It's state by state, but long story short about her, let me tell you. Mm-hmm. They didn't stay together, and then she wrote another book and got with a French necrophiliast who drew these really gruesome pictures and wrote a book, and it was an art book, like a coffee table book.
Oh, nice.
Can't make that up. Whatever. So Gerald went on to do what he does best, Jen. He was mad. He sued her, claiming she stole his work. The case was, of course, tossed out. So he tried to sue another true crime writer who described Gerald as overweight. Gerald was upset that the writer called him overweight. So
Gerald's got some problems.
He does. But that's okay because he's still got some lawsuits to go. So then he decided to try to sue former FBI agent Robert Ressler. You know him, famous profiler, for describing him as a serial killer.
Oh.
Again, tossed out. Thank goodness.
Well, it worked so well the first time. So
right. Mm-hmm. Now, Sandra, his ex-girlfriend, went on to testify in court saying that Gerald Schaefer was responsible for the cold case murders tied to the Ocala National Forest that we talked about earlier. The victims were Nancy Leichner and Pamela Nader, who had disappeared 40 years before in October 1966 after taking a walk through the nature trails. Their bodies have never been found. The case was then closed with Gerald Schaefer being held responsible for their deaths.
Nice. Did he get time added for that?
No. Oh, he got time added, buddy. You ready? On December 3rd, 1995, another inmate barged into a cell, slashed Gerald Schaefer's throat, stabbed him in both eyes, and over 40 times in the neck and head area. Prison officials named the killer as inmate Vincent Rivera, who was serving life plus 20 years for two murders in Tampa, but no specific motive had been offered on why he stormed in there that day and killed Gerald. Some say it was because he was a rat and a snitch, and he did. He would trade out things and, like, tell on people and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He was not very well liked by prison inmates and the staff.
Not if he's doing that, no.
No, all that stuff, right? With Gerald finally gone, officials could freely share their thoughts on Gerald Schaefer without being sued by him. I just thought this was really kind of funny, but it's very alarming at the same time. Bill Hagerty, who's an ex-FBI agent, had studied Gerald Schaefer in the early 1980s and called him one of the sickest. If I had a list of the top five, which would include all of the serial killers I've interviewed throughout the country, he would definitely be in the top five.
Oh, wow.
Georgia Jessup's mother, Shirley Jessup, it was justice served. She says, I'd like to send a present to the guy who killed him. I've always believed he was going to get this. I just wish it would have been much sooner than later. That is the story on Gerald Schaefer.
AKA Jerry Shepard.
Police officer. And, you know, how many times have we said this? You know he's had to kill a lot more people. You know he has. You just know it.
A lot more people. Mm-hmm.
Like, these names are popping up. So these pictures that I found of his jewelry, it's like a lot. So somebody has to know that. Like his mom, didn't you, you know, maybe once in a while go in that room and like look and say, why is my son storing women's jewelry in here? Oh, look, here's a driver's license. Wasn't this girl missing? I mean, come on. Am
I
right?
I think so. But I think a lot of people also don't want to admit that there's problems.
I guess, but come on.
They're purposefully blind so they don't have to deal with it, I guess, or admit that the person that they've raised is some
terrible.
Kind of animal.
Yeah, terrible.
He's a horrible person, and I don't condone vigilantism at all or killing of anyone for any reason, but I'm not really sad about his death, to be quite honest.
Me neither, Jen. Me neither. Just the fact that his psyche, that he would go and, I don't know, tie these women up. I mean, what a gruesome, gross, horrible way to die. You're being tied up next to somebody, one of your friends or whatever, you know?
Not only that, I mean,
tortured.
It's horrible, but how frightened must they have been?
Terrible.
How scared they must have been. That alone frightens me.
I don't know. And like, he fake kidnapped those girls and then said that to his superior and superiors. Like, yeah, loser, you're fired. But
yeah.
When he was out on bond for that, he committed yet another two murders that we know about. So it just makes me wonder, like, and I know times are different, but how did people not? That's not normal behavior. Nobody goes and gets two girls and ties them up to a tree and says, I'm going to be back later. I think maybe you need to look in the background a little bit. You know, let's go research this guy a little bit.
You would think, but then once again, it's that you would never suspect that somebody that you work with would be like that.
I don't know.
Hence the whole John Wayne Gacy. Oh, he was such a nice guy. He was so quiet. I never in a million years would have thought he would have done that.
Whatever. I mean, he's a priest, teacher, cop, you know.
Well, he never was a priest, remember? Couldn't.
Priest wannabe. There you
priest
go.
Priest wannabe. But I can't be a priest. I'm going to be a serial killer, but God damn it, don't call me a serial killer. Or fat.
Or I'll sue you.
Or I'll sue you.
I'm like, oh, Jesus. Ah, Jesus. Stupid. All right, that's all I got for you,
Jen.
That
was really interesting, and you are correct. I had never heard of that POS at all.
How did I even end up on him?
Ted Bundy thing, the connection?
Mm-hmm. And I guess they were pretty good friends until confidants, I guess. But, you know, they probably sickly remembered the women killing and all that stuff. They couldn't see how these girls and women were killed, so they couldn't really say, was it murder, was it not? Yet they're all connected to him. That kills me.
Uh-huh.
You know? All right, that's all I got, Jen.
That was good.
All right, Jen, so, hey, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Bain. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.
Hey, 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 Jen. Hey.
That's nice.
I was doing the hey, hey, Jen, Fat Albert thing, and then in the middle of it, I decided I didn't want to do it. So, yeah.
Should we try it again?
Yeah, probably.
That'll be a blooper.
So, Jen, we all know better.
Sorry. What was that?
Come on up. I got something in my mouth. My ear's itching. Jesus.
You're a mess. And I'm hot, you know, freaking mess.
Express. Toot, toot. All aboard. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Now, in his teens, Gerald Schaefer became obsessed with women's panties. And he also became.
Sorry.
I'm going to do that again.
That's that important. Just threw me. Sorry.
I know.
Can you use underwear or not panties?
I like panties because panties are girls only. Underwear can be boys or girls in my world.
But can you just say women's underwear instead of panties? Mm-hmm. I hate the name. I hate panties. It
panties,
sounds...
panties, panties,
no,
panties,
I hate
that's
it when
I'm
they're...
in every episode.
Now. No, I... It just... I always call panties. Them panties as a joke, but it kind of makes them, I don't know, not as serious, I guess, as...
They're sexy panties.
Okay. Whatever.
What did you want me to call them? Underwear?
Just women's underwear instead of panties.
Undergarments?
Underwear works.
The dainty undergarments?
Well,
the privates. How about bloomers? Got a little bloomer? I got my bloomers on. Skivvies. He's in a skivvies.
I just think panties is a, like for little kids. You know what I'm saying?
Mostly I always think it's a woman. Underwear, kids wear underwear. Women wear panties.
No, because I always go put your panties on for like little kids. Now I say, put some goddamn underwear on. I'm tired you walk around naked in the house. And that's not just for my husband. No.
No kidding. Okay, here we go. Okay. Sorry, Nico. But see, he learned because he couldn't give him the real name just in case something happened, right? So he learned from the previous
mistake. But come on, if you're saying, well, my son or my daughter left with somebody by the name of Jerry Shepherd. Huh. Well, let's see. Could that be Gerald Schaefer?
Well, I don't know. People call me Pam Henderson.
I just call you bitch, but that's a different game. Ooh.
And I like it.
I know you do.
Okay. Sorry, Nico. We're both on fire right now. Just put it at the end. Put it at the end, buddy.
I'm sure they were only married so they could have the...
You'd think.
The marriage.
I don't...
I wanted to say conjunction.
I'm blanking. Conjunction. What's your function? Congenital. Nope. What the hell is it called? Congenial.
Nope.
That's not it either.
What is it?
Oh my God.
Why can't I think of it?
I can't either. I can't think.
They wanted to have the sex.
So you get married. I don't know if I couldn't find that they did that, but that's not the whole point. You ready?
Yeah. Never mind. You can take that out, Nico.
No, it's funny.
I know.
Congenial. No. Nope.
Well, conceptual. Congenial would be.
That's not it, though. I don't know. Okay. It was shocking to me that he was at a minimum.
Conjugal. Conjugal.
Conjugal.
That's what Thank the word. You. Conjugal visits.
Congenial. Yeah. Conjugal.
Damn.
Anybody there? The
we're smart. SMRT smart.
Right, money.